there, but
we do miss you.
I am also a member of the Governor's Juvenile Justice Commission, and I'm the co-chair of the Policy, Legislation, and Compliance Subcommittee. And I'm here to amplify the voice of the commission, but also to add my perspective on two areas that I don't think have been covered yet. I worked for 40 years for the state public defender, most recently as a manager of the Waukesha, Jefferson, Washington, and Ozaukee County offices. And much of my practice was as a juvenile defender. I also worked for 18 years as an adjunct professor of law at Marquette University, teaching the juvenile law course. So I taught many prosecutors and defenders during my time there. Another thing that is relevant is that I was the former chair of the Waukesha County Juvenile Justice Subcommittee, which was part of the collaborating council in Waukesha, which was one of the first in the state. The first point I want to address is that courtroom shackling impacts non-delinquent children. The appendix shows that all four of the counties in my former practice area practice indiscriminate shackling of juveniles in court proceedings. And of course, that means that it doesn't matter if the child is alleged delinquent, the seriousness of the offense, or whether it's a juvenile in need of protection or service cases or a child in need of protection or services. As chair of the Juvenile Justice Subcommittee in Waukesha, we would periodically examine census data for secure detention. And during my tenure, at some parts of the time, half of the children placed in secure detention in Waukesha County were status offenders. That means they were not accused of committing any crime, but they were simply in secure detention because they ran away from a non-secure custody status, sometimes just violating a home detention order with electronic monitoring, even though they had never been accused of violating the law. If they were in secure detention, they had to appear in court, and if they had to appear in court, they were shackled. Now, the practice in Washington, Ozaukee, and Jefferson is the same. And even though I can't speak to the numbers, I did check with colleagues just last week, and they report that status offenders still periodically appear and that they do appear in restraints. Now, there has been a big shift in Waukesha County, but it hasn't been because they changed the practice or thoughtfully changed the policy. The change in Waukesha has occurred because they closed the shelter care facility. And secondly, they closed the secure detention facility. And inadvertently, but beneficially to children, the number of kids in secure detention have dropped dramatically. So who are these kids that run away? Well, many, if not most, of the children that are shackled and are in these runaway positions are vulnerable trauma victims themselves. The runaway usually reflects much deeper problems which bring them to the court to begin with. The second area that I want to comment on is that I think that a court rule is necessary and appropriate, and I draw upon my experience as a member of the court's PPAC subcommittee on the use of video conferencing technology in the courtroom. And as the court is aware, the result of the recommendations that came from our participation on that committee resulted in the enactment of a rule that became Chapter 885, which now provides great guidance to participants and litigants on the use of video court technology. But with respect to juvenile shackling, there is no statutory or judicial reference point to guide judges or practitioners in this area. More often than not, if you were to go to another county to try to determine what the practice is, you would have to tap the bailiff on the shoulder and just ask, what is the practice or what is the rule? Most counties that do employ indiscriminate shackling do so without a local court rule or written guidelines. They simply defer to the local sheriff. I don't believe that the enactment of the rule actually violates any concern about separation of powers or unduly interferes with the needs of law enforcement. The rule petition does not address custodial decisions or use of restraints outside of the courtroom. But I think what the rule does is puts the balancing that's required in this situation. Do we have to choose between harm to children or protection of the public and protection of the courtroom? It puts the balancing squarely in the hands of the judiciary, which it should be. I think that your typical deputy at the low end of the decision point is not in a position to really make that balancing call themselves. And more often than not, they simply defer to the zero risk alternative, which is to shackle all children. So thank you for the opportunity to share my comments. I really look at approval of this rule as an opportunity to reduce harm to children in court proceedings and hopefully lead to better outcomes, which ultimately will strengthen communities and strengthen community safety. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Next, we have the Executive Director of Wisconsin Catholic Conference.
I really thought the two-inch heels would do it today, but no.
You didn't know you'd have an extra journey.
That's right. So I'll speak briefly today and just bring up a few points not brought up by others. My name is Kim Burkotter, and as mentioned, I'm the executive director of the Wisconsin Catholic Conference. If you're not familiar with our entity, and that's highly possible, we represent on a good day, 1.2 million Catholics in Wisconsin and the five Roman Catholic dioceses, along with the Catholic bishops of Wisconsin. And we speak not only from the perspective of our parishes, Catholic schools, hospitals, and charitable entities, as well as our chaplain and prison ministries, but also our agency serves on the Religious Advisory and Practices Committee of the Department of Corrections. And we also just speak from the perspective of preserving the right and dignity of every human person. So a few things I just want to mention today. Obviously, we're here in support of the proposed rule. We think that while a young brain is still being formed, it is essential that adults utilize age-appropriate means to ensure that that child is turned into a responsible adult, and we teach that through learned behavior. An example of this is in 2011, in this building in a different hearing, Wisconsin enacted a law that protects all students, both with and without disabilities, by prohibiting the use of physical restraint or seclusion in schools. That's Wisconsin Statute Section 118.305. We're here to advocate that if our Wisconsin education system for over a decade has recognized the impact of undue restraint on children, we'd ask that the same consideration be provided to children in our criminal justice system. And to add to that, just what all have provided regarding trauma, I would just point to the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. It was created by the U.S. Congress in 2000 and a part of the Children's Health Act. It's funded through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. They did a review in 2014, specifically trauma among girls in the juvenile justice system, and it actually builds upon reports that they did in 2007 and 2013. They found that there were significantly higher rates of traumatic events among kids in our juvenile justice system than among community youth. It depends on the study you read. It's anywhere from 70 to 96% higher in terms of experiencing some form of trauma. But that's one possible reference, I would say, that probably hasn't been mentioned yet. The other is just a quote from that 2014 study that I'd like to provide. It says, "Interviews with stakeholders in the justice system, including staff, parents, and girls themselves, confirm that many characteristics of juvenile courts and detention environments can be experienced as re-traumatizing. These include overtly physical, intrusive, and threatening detention procedures, such as being handcuffed, restrained, or strip searched, witnessing violence among peers in the facility, or observing takedowns and other kinds of restrictive procedures being implemented against other youth by staff." I say that because the study goes on to state how once you've been a traumatized individual, you are more likely to respond negatively when someone inflicts some sort of restraint upon you. If you've had your person violated before, when someone restrains you again, you're likely to respond and act negatively, even more so among vulnerable individuals like children who are less able to exert self-discipline. Therefore, restraints can actually be counterproductive to what we're trying to achieve in court, which is some form of restorative justice and putting that juvenile back on a good path to being a productive member of society. I think that's the bulk of my comments. The others have been mentioned by others. So I thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you. All right, last but not least, Judge Gonzalez.
I'm leaning a lot more than 2-inch heels to be able to get this podium.
There we go.
May it please the court. You know, I've not said those words in this chamber before because I did not argue cases before the Supreme Court. But I come to you today to make an argument, to make a plea for the children of Wisconsin, for my deputies who work with those children every day, and with judges and all of us who have toiled for a very long time to have this day come. My journey to this day started long before it came to Wisconsin. The National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges is comprised of family and juvenile judges across the country. We struggled with this issue. We had judges who wanted to continue to do it the way they do, asking for the exception to the status offense. We have to put kids, runaway kids, have to be in detention because we can't keep them safe if we don't know where they are. And we struggled, I venture to say, for almost a decade. But in 2015, we had consensus. And in 2015, we passed a resolution, and that resolution took a position on shackling. There's indiscriminate shackling of children. And I just want to draw your attention, I believe it's part of the submissions, that the last sentence of that resolution reads, the NCJ-FCJ believes judges should have the ultimate authority to determine whether or not a child needs to be shackled in a courtroom. That's easy to write, easy to read, but it was a lot of work to get to that sentence. I took that sentence in July of 2015, and I took it home. I had been working with my court officers to figure out what we could do to make their jobs easier. And the way my courtroom is set up, I have my jury room outside of my chambers. And they bring the juveniles that are in detention, and they sit them in my jury room while they're waiting to come into court. I had the experience over 15 years to listen, overhear those conversations, and to hear that interaction between those deputies and those children. And over all that time, I understood that that deputy understood more about that kid because they've seen him before, and unfortunately, we now just call them repeat offenders or repeaters, but they were children to my deputies. And I said, if that deputy could feel comfortable in my jury room having that nice conversation with this kid, I can't do the same thing in the courtroom. Because that kid is shackled and that kid's not looking at me. And that kid doesn't have an experience with me because it's an initial appearance and he hasn't seen me before. So I came back from the NCJ-FCJ and I said, how am I going to do this? And quite frankly, I did not think, Justice Hagedorn, that the rest of the state was ready. Because there were a lot of people who were saying, this is how we do it. So I looked at my court officer and I said, well, how do we get this done? And they said, Judge, this is a court security issue. You have a committee. So we went to our court security committee and said, okay, this is what we want to accomplish. In that meeting is the sheriff, the DA, the public defender, everyone whose business it is to keep my building safe. And we talked and we hashed, and eventually we came out with a protocol that we kept confidential because it is part of the security committee. Part of the security manual for La Crosse County. Why did we do that? Because there was a complete portion of that room that said, Judge, if we tell people we're not going to shackle, they're just going to run amok. They're going to just do whatever they want. I said, well, we don't have to make announcements. Let's just see how this goes. We planted a seed in La Crosse County. The assistance and the partnership of my court deputies. And that seed blossomed. Soon we had Dane County, Milwaukee County. Everyone wants to know why the public defenders want to know what you're doing there. And they have asked me before to participate in going to the legislature, in going to the Supreme Court to do a rule. And each time I resisted. And I'll tell you why I resisted. Because I did not believe that my judges in Wisconsin, my sheriffs in Wisconsin, were ready. But now we have data. We have the experience of Milwaukee County.
We have the experience of Dane County. We have the experience of Waukesha brought about by what? Economic reasons, because they closed those detention centers. And now the time has come. It is more than come. I don't take this opportunity to stand at this lectern very easily. I have been in this room twice that are memorable to me. One, when Dean Bowden moved me in to become a lawyer, where I promised under oath to do what I needed to do, and today. Because, ladies and gentlemen, to me, honorable justices, this is about the future of our children. This is about those deputies who want to do the right thing but don't have the ability to stand up to somebody else who's been there longer, who says, this is the way we do it. So I implore you to do it for Wisconsin's children. I implore you to do it for those deputies who work hand in hand with those children, and put the decision where it needs to be, judges and their court officers. I'm open to any questions.
All right, proof that there still is more to be said. Thank you for making the trip. Thank you for making the trip, really, everyone. We appreciate the time, attention, the heart and soul, and everything else that you put into this. And we will take it under serious consideration. Safe travels to all of you as you venture back to where you came. And I think you'll get out of here without another fire alarm, hopefully. Okay, take care. And I think at this point, we won't take a break before we proceed on to the next rule. So feel free to go ahead and head out or stay, either way, if you're interested in location of court. And 2103, Amendment to 75324, 75326, 75712, 75714, 75770. Presenters, the Director Koshnick, Judge Rozelle, speakers Kate Drury and Jonas Bednarik. Okay, I still think there might be a shot that we conclude this morning still. I do have, and a number of us have, a meeting at 12:15, so at the most we'd have to leave by probably 10 after 12 to get there in time. So with that in mind, Judge Koshnick.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good morning to all of the justices. It's a pleasure to be here. I am the Director of State Courts, Judge Randy Koshnick, and the petitioner in this matter. I'll be addressing the court briefly as an introductory matter and then arguing on Section 1. Chief Judge Jason Rozelle will be arguing and presenting on Sections 2 through 6. So this Section 1 deals with 753.24 sub-mem, and it provides that the judge and all participants in a circuit court proceeding may appear remotely. Now, we've known, based upon our history with COVID, that this has been very effective in helping us deal with the pandemic and to keep courts running. This court, in fact, has conducted remote proceedings. When I was here about 10 months ago with Judge Rozelle arguing the predecessor, 2009, we did so remotely. I was reviewing the testimony, and it was all remote at that point. And Chief Judge Maureen Boyle wrote to the court in this matter, and she talks on page 2 of her letter about how it's helped her in her rural District 10 to meet the needs of the courts. What I'd like to emphasize today is how important it is for me to have this amended to allow the courts to deal effectively with the backlog. One of my main concerns right now is addressing the backlog, primarily in criminal cases, primarily in Milwaukee County. So as I've been talking to other judges around the state, including the chief judges, we're trying to figure out a way that we can address the backlog in criminal. And without getting too bogged down in the details, it's still in development, what I need is flexibility. So what I'm talking to the Chief Judge Trigiano in Milwaukee about is shifting several of her non-criminal judges to criminal courts so they can conduct jury trials and work on that backlog of criminal felony cases primarily. I don't want to neglect the civil cases, so I need to deal with them as well. And so what I've been talking to some of the reserve judges about is they could handle some of the civil, non-criminal cases. And if they could do so remotely, it would give us tremendous flexibility to zoom in and take care of those non-criminal cases primarily. By Zoom remotely, we could use our remote court reporters. I think you've all heard about the RAMDAR program, Remote Monitored Digital Audio Recording. So we can have flexibility to use court reporters from all over the state to cover proceedings in different counties around the state. One final example, I was at the Chief Judge meeting last Friday. We're all brainstorming on how we can address the backlog. Chief Judge Morrison from Marinette County walks up to Judge Carl Ashley, Deputy Chief Judge in Milwaukee County, and says, "Judge Ashley, if I had a day open up in Marinette and I knew ahead of time, could I zoom in and take some of your civil cases in Milwaukee and allow one of your civil judges to do a spin court, they call it, and handle a felony jury trial?" And Judge Ashley said, "Yes, that'd be wonderful. It'd be nice to have that option. It would take some logistics, but it would be great to have that option." So primarily what it offers is flexibility. We know it works because of our experience with the pandemic, but I'd like to have clear statutory authority for the judge and participants to appear remotely. Those are my comments in Section 1. I'm happy to take questions or turn it over to Judge Rozelle for the remaining sections.
Thank you, Judge Koshnick. I do have one or two questions for you quickly. One concern I think I have, I don't know if my colleagues have the same concern, is that video conferencing might become the new norm or the default. And I come from a civil background as an attorney, and there were a lot of hearings that could have been done very effectively had we had the technology and if it had been something that was okay to do. So I'm very supportive of it. I think we've seen in the pandemic that it's very effective. But we just heard a petition about juvenile court, and I was a judge in juvenile court, and I don't think I could have had the same level of interaction. Maybe Judge Rozelle can respond to this as well, because I know he has spent time with a juvenile calendar as well. But I wouldn't want it to become the default so that the kids are not in the same room with the judge. And it would impede, I think, the ability of the judge to develop the rapport and the relationship with the child who has a case before the judge. So if you could address those concerns. Thank you.
Justice Bradley. So I'm trying to give, options to the systems we can address unforeseen circumstances. Who would have seen the pandemic coming? Who would have seen the civil unrest in Kenosha County? There are other interrelated provisions, and I don't want to get too bogged down on them, but 885, which used to be joined with the same petition, has now been separated. The video conferencing statute does provide a veto for the defense lawyer or the defendant in a criminal or juvenile case to object to a judge's determination to use video conferencing. So there can be limitations in place that protect that concern, that now become the default. There are constitutional requirements concerning face-to-face confrontation, which obviously supersede any statute or rule that we might have on the books. We have experience to show us that has not become the norm. Courts have returned largely to in-person proceedings since the pandemic has started to subside. So we know from experience that there has not been a major problem with this. I think most judges prefer to be in the courtroom in person like we are today. I prefer it. I've received very few complaints during the pandemic about remote access. We actually improved access to the media, to the public. We heard from victims groups last time we had a hearing on video conferencing petition that victims frequently prefer to appear by Zoom. They have to be in the same room as their perpetrator. Divorce litigants, divorce lawyers have told me that they prefer it's better for their clients not to be in the same room during a contentious divorce proceeding. I think the judges in Wisconsin have been very good at exercising their discretion to use it when appropriate, but not to abuse it.
Thank you.
Director Koshnick, I have a question, and this relates to a comment that was given by the State Public Defender's Office. I read the rule as stating that it may be held subject to, and it lists these statutes, which are subject to amendment, I know, and so it's unclear what those boundaries are going to be, but subject to 885.50 to 885.64 and constitutional requirements. But, for example, 971.04 also sets a standard for a plea hearing and in the courtroom as the presiding judge, and that's not listed in this. So shouldn't this statute also include other statutory provisions that govern when and how a court should be able to conduct remote proceedings?
I don't know if they all need to be incorporated in this statute. They would need to be considered by a judge who is making a decision whether to have a remote proceeding or not. And so there is criminal case law, which is cited in the public defender's letter, I think, which lays out the defendant's right to be present in the same courtroom with the judge.
Right, but the rule doesn't say that. The rule really just restricts the judge to 885, 50 to 64 and constitutional requirements. Shouldn't it be a little broader so that it can encompass other statutes that we may not, I may not even be thinking of? This is the one out. That's my question.
Right. I wouldn't see a problem adding that as a restriction, subject also to this other statute. There are probably a number of statutes that could be added.
So maybe subject to other statutory requirements instead of just being as specific as this?
Yes, that's true. It's unclear now from the current statute that a judge can be anywhere other than in the courtroom, in the county seat, in the county where the judge has been elected. So I'm trying to make it clear that we can legally conduct remote proceedings in appropriate circumstances.
Thank you.
I also...
Justice Kurowski?
Okay, thank you. I think I just stepped on someone's toes, but I'm not sure who they were. Apologies. Judge Kostin, can we just ask you a question about the backlog? In talking with some of our colleagues on the Milwaukee and Dane County benches, it's my understanding that one of the biggest, if not the biggest hurdle to tackling the backlog is the not enough DAs or public defenders. And even if you opened up video conferencing so that there would be more judges available, it does not increase the numbers of attorneys from the DA's office or public defender or the private bar to handle the criminal backlog. So do you have any response to that? I'm just not sure how this is going to solve the problem if we don't have enough people to show up in court to litigate these cases.
Yes, I've given this a great amount of thought, and there are a number of moving parts and partners. So we have to partner with the district attorneys and the public defenders. Waukesha County has a very effective backlog reduction program. The court system there convinced the county to provide, I think, $1 to $2 million of ARPA money to hire a 2-year contract special prosecutor, maybe 2 or 3 of them, a few extra court commissioners, some support staff. And I think they're also able to use the money to pay more for court-appointed lawyers and public defender cases. So you do need to have, yes, more clerks, more prosecutors, more defense lawyers, more bailiffs. And so as I'm talking to chief judges around the state, what I encouraged them to do actually last Friday, I gave them a list of how much ARPA money each county in the state got, tens of millions of dollars in most cases, and said, please talk to your county administrator, county executive, and ask for some ARPA money to help us address the backlog. Contract DAs, more money for privately or county-appointed private lawyers to do criminal cases, all very interesting questions of resources. But this is the court's piece. We need to have the courts ready, willing, and able to accommodate jury trials, and then we can work with our partners to make sure that they're ready to proceed as well once we have those courts and judges available.
And Justice Kurowski, just this is Annette Sigler talking. Director Koshnick and I have been really brainstorming on overtime here, trying to find ways to deal with bottlenecks in the system, because there are a number of them, and also try to make sure everyone's rights, statutorily or otherwise, are protected. And there are certain things that we learned during the course of the pandemic that work well and other things that don't work well, but I think we're going to have to be fairly creative in trying to find ways to make sure we have cases heard the best possible way that we can have them heard. So it's not merely just public defenders or DAs, it's court reporters, it's a lot of bottlenecks that come up along the way. And there are hurdles that we're trying hard to deal with respect to all those things. So I don't want you to think that we haven't been working on this, because we are working pretty diligently on trying to see how we can best go forward to make sure we accommodate all the problems and concerns, as well as try to create some solutions, because there's backlogs differ. I mean, in juvenile court, you just heard there aren't a lot of them, but in other areas, there are great numbers of them, and it's not good. So we're working hard to try to find more creative ways. I don't know if that helps at all answer any of your questions.
I wish that I had prefaced my comments by saying that I appreciate the work that Judge Koshnick has done. I know that you have been working tirelessly. I know that the chief judges around the state have been working to address this problem, as have the individual judges. So I wish I had prefaced it that way, so I'll end with that instead. But I appreciate the work of all of you, and I completely understand the bottlenecks at many, many points in the system.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Justice Bradley, did you have a question?
Yes, I have two questions. I understand that the statutory requirement regarding sentencing, being present at sentencing and at plea hearings, that the court addressed in the Anderson case and the Soto case, is clearly, yes, the law. Do you anticipate attempting to try to change that in any way? And if not, should we add to Section 1 and statutory requirements? We previously added in constitutional requirements. What are your thoughts?
I have no intention of changing any substantive law. I wanted to give the courts procedural options to deal with the backlog effectively at administrators like myself.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it has to do with how you deal with the 2009A petition dealing with video conferencing. If the court declines to remove the defense counsel's power to veto the judge's decision on video conferencing in juvenile criminal matters, that would, I think, apply in those situations, trials, sentencing, and so forth. And my, as far as my personal intentions are concerned, as you've asked about, I really see using this in civil cases to allow reserve judges or judges from out of state to take over civil dockets so that elected judges in Milwaukee can do felony jury trials in Milwaukee County cases.
So why shouldn't we be adding, in addition to and constitutional requirements and statutory requirements? Should we or shouldn't we?
I have no problem with you doing that.
I thought you answered Justice Dallet in that regard just a little bit ago, that you had no problem with that change. It was essentially the exact same question, I think, unless I misheard something.
Right. I have no problem adding that. And when we were here a year ago on this, there was no objection to this section, as far as I recall. And so there was an objection. It was about the constitutional implications, so I added subject to the Constitution.
An area that you may not have thought of in terms of location of courts arises, and maybe it's not at all implicated here. Previously, there was a request that this court, and I don't recall if it was in a rule petition or otherwise, would allow a court, for instance, to be held in a gymnasium at a high school as an educational event, and I recall them being shackled and kids being brought in. And the court at that time took a dim view of that, essentially for decorum, integrity of the court process reasons. How, if at all, does this weigh upon that kind of potential remote situation?
Well, I can't imagine every possible way this could be used. And again, I think we have to trust judges, frankly, as elected constitutional officers to exercise good judgment. I think judges are aware generally of the need to have appropriate decorum.
You know, it's one of these things. Of course judges are, until the end. You know, and that was the problem that was arising, that some judges wanted. Does this allow for that? It certainly doesn't address it on its face, but does this allow for that eventuality if a judge wants to do that?
Isn't this telephone or video conferencing technology?
Yes.
So this isn't moving an entire court to a gymnasium. This is allowing people to do a lot of what they've been doing, right?
Well, but I don't know. Let him answer the question if he can. Does this allow for that kind of remote location? I know that it wasn't intended to. I'm just asking if it would allow for it.
I think the language that I proposed would. It doesn't specify where the person is when they're remote. They could be in a gymnasium. They could be at home.
I
know, speaking of gymnasiums, during the pandemic, one of the problems we had up north was picking juries. I think it was one of the first counties to have a jury trial after the special orders was Bayfield or Ashland, and they couldn't find a big enough building in their county to pick a jury, and they wanted to go to the neighboring county to use, I think, a gymnasium, but they weren't authorized to do it under 753.24, so they had to use a less suitable, smaller facility in their own county. I think a movie theater or a smaller gymnasium, I'm not sure. Sometimes it is appropriate to use that type of facility for that type of a purpose.
A hotel? A convention center.
Yeah.
I mean, we had to be creative.
I understand that. As I'm asking you questions, I understand that. I'm just wondering if under this language it can be used in an unanticipated way, a way that this court, with different members, thought would be counter to the best interest of the court. But
I'm sure it could. I think one of the benefits that the pandemic has given us is the benefit of experience. And it's been 2 years now, and I just haven't seen this abused. I think judges have been using their discretion. The public's been well-served. Litigants have been well-served. I think it's really been a pretty smooth operation, if I say so myself, and I've not seen any abuses like that. If they were going to do that, they could have done that since March of 20 with the Zoom technology we provided.
Thank you.
All right. Then, Judge Roussel.
Thank you.
You do not think I need to move the podium, so that's perfect. Chief Justice, members, and justices of the Supreme Court, thank you once again for hearing this petition and for allowing me to speak to it. As Director Koshnick indicated, the last time I testified on this matter, I was in Florida, where it was much warmer via video conferencing. After a very long year, I won't repeat my testimony from then, but I'm sure you all remember what occurred in August 23rd, 2020, when the courthouse of Kenosha was completely unavailable. Bullet holes were in windows, doors were already pried open, petrol bombs had been thrown into the windows of two separate court areas. Our courthouse was not available to either judges or the public. An 8-foot fence very quickly surrounded the entire property. In that situation, I was faced as a chief judge with one decision: shut down the courts. That's easy. I was then faced with another problem. What do you do now? I said it before, and I find it so important, I'm going to say it again. I believe that the circuit courts of our state have a very important, very necessary constitutional duty and service to our citizens, and that is to protect their rights, to resolve disputes, and to be available for injunctions, not only against other people, but also against the government itself. That is the value of the courthouse. And what I ran into, and the reason why I'm here, is I ran into rules that are antiquated, rules that outdate all of us here, rules that talk about sittings of court. Judge Schrader, the most senior judge in the state of Wisconsin, remembers the sittings of court. The sittings of court where all the cases were heard twice a year. Once in the spring, once in the fall. If you wanted to plead guilty, you had to write a note to the judge to get a hearing to plead guilty. This is not the world we live in. And so the proposal that we bring to you is one that updates those rules, not only for the emergency situations such as the location of court. When there is war, pestilence, famine, civil unrest, fires. Milwaukee County Courthouse, not too many years ago, suffered a fire that shut down their courthouse for over a month. It gives us more locations. The best location for Kenosha was actually outside the county seat. I couldn't move us there. We were able to use it for jury trials during the pandemic, but I couldn't move full courtroom proceedings there because of this rule. I couldn't go up to Racine County, where they have more than enough courtroom space. I couldn't use any of those facilities because I had to remain within the bounds of Kenosha County. So we found another location, and thank goodness for Zoom, and thank goodness for what we had learned during the pandemic. We were able to get going right away. Get going so that the person in criminal court who just needs a hearing to get out of jail can get out of jail. So that someone who has a hearing that everyone's in agreement with. I mean, I understand the concerns, and I think 885 has already indicated, protects the rights of defendants who don't want to appear by Zoom. But a lot of them do. They want their day in court. And if we have no ability to move the court in those situations, we are denying them that ability to have their day in court. It also gave us the ability not only to broaden the locations as Section 3 talks about, but to expand the access, and that's where Section 4 goes, which is 757.14, to use the technology that we've learned to live stream to the world and to the public of Wisconsin and to give them those opportunities. You've already heard about the flexibility that this would also give courts, but that's more of a secondary issue to the part that I'm discussing. I'm talking about when a chief judge runs into a situation of a fire, of civil unrest. We just had a massive trial in Kenosha. Won't talk too much about it, but we were ready to go in case, once again, our courthouse was shut down due to civil unrest. And then the other thing that does it, just to speak real quickly on Section 2, is it removes antiquated provisions. Rock County has not had a second courthouse since 1999. Yet the rules call for them to have four courts down in Beloit. The rules also call for us to hold books and records, while other statutory provisions already handle that. All of our records are electronic. They're all held by the clerk of courts, and they're all held in the county seat. And those are statutes that we're not asking to change. All this does is update the fact that the only public record that a judge actually has is their email, and that's held electronically here in Madison.
What are those statutes? Because I was concerned about this section.
Yes.
Because it looks like you're taking away the ability of people to access documents when people may not have access to the Internet.
Right.
So what are the statutes that protect those, if you know?
It's 54. It's the one that deals with the duties of the clerk of circuit court.
Okay.
I believe it was in our...
I didn't see it, but that doesn't mean it's not there.
It's 5940 sub 2. And 753.30.
And you think those sufficiently address the points to the tune of repealing Section 2? I get that Rock County piece is accurate, but what about the rest of it?
The rest of it, we don't keep anything. We don't keep their own decisions. We don't keep the files. Those
don't
are not
have
ours.
That now.
No, we don't have those now because that's the duty of the clerk of circuit court. So we don't have books. Like I said, the only public record I have is my email. And that is maintained by CCAP here in Madison. So if someone asks me for a public record request for emails, I have to contact them. If someone asks me for a public record request for something that's in the file, I direct them to the custodian of the record, who is the clerk of circuit courts.
And that's where people can go to get physical copies as well.
Correct. And this does not move the location of the courthouse in the sense that we're not asking that courthouses be able to be placed in hard-to-get locations very far away, but rather to allow us in those moments of what are we going to do for the next 2 weeks while there's a 12-foot high fence and it's unsafe? What do we do in those moments?
Well, I have you. Since I've interrupted anyway, I'm sorry. I also had another question about why you removed the chief judge approval to move the local court, and that's a concern of the public defender. And frankly, it concerns me as well because I trust our fellow. I mean, we have wonderful judges throughout the state, but this really gives a lot of control over movement of their courtroom without anyone else kind of overseeing that.
I think there's two protections for that. The reason why we removed the chief judge is for mostly the up north counties. District 10 and 17 are almost two-thirds of our state. They're very large geographical distances. The chief judge may not be available at a drop of the hat to make a decision like this. We provide notice to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the Chief Judge, who have separate statutory powers in the Supreme Court rules, to be able to say to that judge, come back to the courthouse. We're not closing the courthouse. So there's separate rules that would give the power either to the Chief Justice of this honorable body or to the Chief Judge, and those would be found, I believe it's SCR 70, is the duties of the chief judge.
There was a real concern that you couldn't get a chief judge's approval?
There was because So I go on vacation.
They have their phones on, right? Everybody's got their phones. Well, do you have a deputy then if you put someone else in charge of your chief judge duties while you're on vacation?
Well,
they're acting?
Right. There is vacation. The difficulty that occurs, I'm going to be frank. The majority of the chief judges do not take the relief that is provided in the statute. I work a 1.66 FTE according to the statutes. I work 1 2/3 jobs plus a chief judge job. There are days where if you call on a chief judge issue, you're going to get me somewhere between 3:30 and 4:30. Now, yes, if it's a courthouse burning down, I'm probably going to stop what's in front of me.
Aren't you going to know, right?
Right, but I don't have the ability in that moment when a decision needs to be made and the judge is like, we need to take off and do something over here, for me to immediately respond. And that was the onus of taking that provision out, because there were other provisions that still allowed the chief judge to have input and still allowed the chief justice to have input also. So it's protected in other ways.
Help me as a follow-up to that. Again, how is it protected in other ways? Regardless, you know, chief judges have a turnover. All of us will come and go. But we have a structure. And our structure has been focused in the past with the chief judge of a district, both in practice and in rule or statute, having certain authority. And it seems like this is bypassing that. As a structure, I just don't understand why we would do that. But you say, don't worry, it's taken care of other places.
I think it is. Justice Bradley, I think it is addressed in other places, not only the authority of this court as a superintending body and the Chief Justice as the superintending authority, but I believe in the duties of the Chief Judge that is given to the Chief Judge by this body gives us the ability to do that without having the structure in this rule. And I understand the concern of not having it spelled out specifically in this rule, but I don't think it's a necessity to have it. I think we're protected in either direction, to be honest with you. Whether it's in there or not, there are provisions which would allow a chief judge to say, sorry, you're not going to be in Florida doing your cases here in Kenosha or there.
That sounds right, but, you know, I come from this trust but verify sort of thing. So can you tell me where it is?
It's wherever the chief judge duties are. I apologize. I left my yellow book down.
I'll take a look. Thank you.
I believe it's Rule 60, but I think it's like 20. Mm-hmm.
Judge Russell, I mean, ultimately, every circuit court judge is elected by the people who live in that county. And so ultimately, every judge is accountable to the voters and to the citizens of the county. So does that give you additional comfort that a circuit court judge is not going to take advantage of the rule and decide to spend the winter in Florida and conduct all of his or her cases there?
It does, Justice Bradley. And you asked a very good question of the director that was somewhat related about being in person versus being virtual. And the judges do want to be in the courtroom. I'm so thankful I'm here in front of you here today instead of a screen. And that's what the judges of the counties think, too, whether it be in juvenile court or...
Rather than Florida? Wouldn't you rather be in Florida, Justin?
I miss my parents. So I miss them. But in all honesty, judges are not only elected individuals. They're highly functioning individuals who've taken a oath to support and defend the Constitution. They want to do the right thing, every single one of them.
That's right, you know, and I have very high regard for what I call our judicial family, very high regard. But, you know, there have been the good old Alex Ranieri, judges who commit felonies and have houses of prostitution, you know, a little bit of gambling on the side, right? We have judges who people have complained in the past who talk to the pictures on the wall. So, you know, it's not infallible. And so it's nice to have a structure that takes care of very unique and errant circumstances.
And I know I've said this before, Justice Bradley, but I do believe that there's sufficient authority already laid out in statute that would allow those situations to be dealt with very quickly.
Yes, indeed.
And you also believe there's going to be notice to those individuals, because even if I look at the, I mean, there's nothing here that, so you're saying the notice goes to the Chief Justice?
It's the Chief Justice, the Chief Judge of the District, County Bar Association, the website, the Director of State Courts.
Before it moves, before the court moves.
So, perfect example. Thank you, Justice Dallas, for reminding me of this. When I had to move the Kenosha County Courts for 2 weeks, when this first issue came to me, my first comment was, I need 48 hours. And they all looked at me, what do you mean 48 hours? I said, well, we've got to give notice. We can't just move. I said, so if today is the day we're starting to give notice, we can start 2 days later.
And so in theory, there could be objections by any one of those individuals.
Right.
Okay.
And then knowledge is out there. Then the Chief Justice can take action or Chief Judge can take action to say this is inappropriate.
All right. Thank
you. Chief Justice, may I ask just one question while we're on this point, please?
All right.
Judge Rossell, I just want you to respond to something, if you would, please. One example that I think comes from the filings of the SPD is they give an example, and apologize to my colleagues who don't like hypotheticals for the hypotheticals, but bear with me, please. Imagine that the courthouse, your courthouse in Kenosha is in the middle of a renovation. So you've got a renovation in a multiple-judge county, and one judge feels that they can remain in the courthouse while another judge believes that that he or she must move their court to an alternate location. So the concern of the SPD is, what if a party has appearances in multiple courtrooms in one day? What if an attorney has multiple appearances and you have to be at two different places, and the logistical challenge that would effectively bar access to the courthouse? Would you respond to that, please?
Sure. I think there are always logistical challenges for attorneys. I was both an assistant district attorney and a defense attorney who took SPD cases. And I don't think that's different than what I handled just yesterday when an attorney said, I have a 1:30 in Racine, I have a 2 o'clock in front of you, I'm going to be late. And I'm like, okay, well, you're going to be late. That's life. And we took his case about 3:15. So I don't think those are different. I think in the situation where you had two judges who are treating a situation radically differently, I think that's where the superintending power of the Chief Judge and the Chief Justice come into effect, because the statute says pestilence, calamity, I apologize, I didn't have it right up in front of me, but it is when there is unusual circumstances. I know one of them speaks as to the issue that it is unsafe, inexpedient reason of war, pestilence, or other public calamity. And so the problem would be is if a judge is saying it's unsafe or inexpedient because we're having a renovation, it doesn't seem to fit with inside the rule itself. I think that judge would find himself on herself on some very unstable ground.
Okay.
Thank you.
We are going to break now.
Okay.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
We will need to attend the meeting. I've been told it takes about 45 minutes. I know people have been here ready since this morning. We had some intervening things happen. So why don't we try to start up in an hour from now and conclude with the two speakers? Does that work for the speakers' schedules?
Justice, I'm sorry, it does not. I have to be in Green County for a sentencing hearing at 2 o'clock. So
shoot.
Okay. No.
All right. Well, I wonder, I'm trying to think if you could go to the meeting and then you could catch up on Wisconsin I. And we could continue on with you.
Please, is my comments, I can't speak.
Could you come to the microphone? We need to make sure it's accessible to.
Sure, I'm sorry. I'm Jonas Bednarik. I'm a partner at Hurley Burrish across the street here, which is fairly conveniently located when there are fire alarms, I found. and really, I'm speaking out of school here, out of turn, because Attorney Drury is here as well, and she was on the docket prior to me. But if I could, I have just very brief comments, and I'm wondering.
Okay. Well, I know, but I'd like to hear what he has to say, catch up on Wisconsin I. So I will be late to the meeting. You've indicated you're willing to watch on Wisconsin I what the comments are.
Yes.
So I'll go late. You can choose if you want to
go late or...
And I can cram these into just 2 minutes, and if that's okay.
Okay.
All I wanted to tell you, and Justice Rebecca Bradley...
I'm going to ask that the meeting downstairs be postponed for 10 minutes, okay? So that
I'm staying.
We have the hope of concluding this. Just ask them to hold tight for 10 minutes, and we'll be down there as soon as we can be.
I appreciate that. In sitting and listening this morning, Justice Rebecca Bradley used the word rapport when you addressed counsel previously about your concern about judges' rapport with litigants. I've practiced in circuit courts in this state for well over 20 years now and made a career of defending people accused of crimes. And I think one of the things that this petition does, we run the very real risk of cutting into that rapport that judges have with defendants, that sometimes victims have with the accused. The rapport that's developed can be scalding, it can be accusatory, it can be, you know, scolding the defendant. Sometimes it's praise, sometimes it's accolades, sometimes it's a very real reaffirmance of how well somebody's doing or how poorly they did. But what it is it's a rapport, and you hit it right on the head, Justice, when you talk about what a circuit court judge does with a defendant in a courtroom. And we can't duplicate that via Zoom. I've tried for the last 18 months or whatever it's been. I've done a bunch of Zoom hearings. I do them all the time. And unfortunately, it's not the same. When I listened to the previous petition, they talked about a kid that came into a courtroom who wanted to wear a suit and tie, and the shackles was inhibiting that. That kid was taking it seriously, and that's not something that people do when they do it on Zoom. I've seen this firsthand. It's an easy out on criminal cases to say, well, I can sign in from my bedroom or from my lake home or for whatever it is. But there's something about walking into a courtroom, this one no exception, that there's a formality, there's a sense of seriousness, and there's an absolute effect on everybody that's involved. And my concern with this petition is very, very simple, that we lose that effect, we water down that effect. I realize there's a power of veto that's written into it. I worry about that because I worry about one of my clients utilizing that power of veto or being concerned about utilizing it and the effect that may have on the tribunal. But and perhaps I'm longer than 2 minutes now, but what I wanted to communicate was that I think that the spirit of a courtroom is lost when we do it via Zoom, and that's why I'm opposing this petition.
Counsel, the counter to that, though, and again, I'm speaking from my children's court experience in Milwaukee County, is that sometimes parents just simply couldn't show up or wouldn't show up because they found the environment too intimidating or they couldn't face what was happening in their lives with respect to their children. And, again, some people just didn't have the means of getting to the courthouse in Wauwatosa because they lived far away. Some people were working and they couldn't get off of work. They'd lose their job. So the video conferencing can help poor people, can help disadvantaged people actually participate in their hearings. So I think there's a balance to be struck. One concern I would have with respect to the veto is that who's really vetoing the idea of appearing by video, and would it be the attorney who might have, you know, this is not an offense to attorneys who, I know public defenders and guardians, et cetera, are balancing really tough schedules sometimes, but they might opt for the video conferencing, and they're client who may be a child is going to say, no, I really want to come to court. How realistic is that? So I think there's I don't know if you want to address it at all, but there's a bit of a balancing that needs to be done there.
It's more convenient. You're absolutely right. It's more convenient to conduct these by video conference. It is. It's more convenient to do it by telephone. That doesn't make it better, and it doesn't change what we've been doing for a long time, and what we've been doing for a long time, I think, works as best as possible. I remember Judge Bill Dyke out in Iowa County. I practiced in front of him a lot. And he had a great way of connecting with people in a courtroom. And he passed away, unfortunately, before all of this pandemic and all these video things. But I would bet that Bill Dyke would have never utilized a Zoom conference to try to do his job.
Counsel, are you familiar
with recent studies and literature as it's developing regarding Zoom and the inability to really correctly assess demeanor and how it affects the ability to assess credibility. Are you familiar with any of those studies or any of the literature that's coming out on it?
I can't say I'm familiar with the studies or literature. I can say I don't doubt that there's a lot of studies and literature along that, those lines, because I would suspect that it impedes or makes more difficult credibility assessments. We also don't know if there are people off camera providing assistance in some way, shape, or form to those that are on camera. It, to me, is not the preferred method of ascertaining the truth and getting our jobs done. So that was way more than 2 minutes. So I will step down, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, why don't you start with your time right now so we can see if we can conclude your remarks before we need to break.
Thank you, Chief Justice. On behalf of the Public Defender's Office, my name is Kate Drury. I'm here as a Wisconsinite who, up until 6 months ago, did not have Internet access in her home. Thank you. I just want to start with that point because Wisconsinites don't have Internet access. Neither do poor people. Neither do my clients. And when we're talking about transitioning into a system, whereas, just as Rebecca Bradley stated, video conferencing becomes the new norm, we need to make sure that we act very carefully.
Counsel, are you familiar with the recent studies, relatively recent, within a year, that indicate 25 to 27% of rural Wisconsin does not have access to reliable Internet?
Justice, I am not familiar with that particular study. But I am familiar with studies that say bonds in immigration court are higher when a judge sets the bond in immigration court using video conferencing technology. I'm also familiar with studies indicating that Zoom takes the frequencies, especially the higher and lower pitch frequencies, and edits it out, which impairs communication. And they do that so that there's better clarity. But in hearings where what the witness is saying matters, where the fact finder is engaging with that witness to try to make credibility determinations, altering how that witness presents is problematic. Our first concern with the petition is exactly what Justice Dallet mentioned in her comments, and it's that Section 75324, as amended, doesn't in and of itself contain limits to the exercise of this expanded judicial power of being able to determine whether court is in person or whether court is conducted virtually. The statute refers us to other places in the law. It refers us to the Constitution, which is an acknowledgement that video conferencing can affect substantive rights of litigants. It also refers us to Chapter 885, which today is subject to a rule change petition. So essentially, the petitioner is asking the court to expand judicial power in this area before the limits of that power or expansion are clearly defined. Using the example that Judge Koshnick gave, if I'm an attorney and I show up to court and the judge is appearing for a Marinette with my client, nothing tells me how I object. There's no procedure for that in the law. Nothing tells us what the remedy would be if the circuit court should err. Turning to the second concern, again, this is addressed by Justice Dallet, but we want to make sure that 75326 be updated to be consistent and not have archaic language in our statutes. But removing it altogether seems to undermine the purpose of the statute, which is to guarantee that the public has access to records at the county seat. And in my read of 75330, which is the circuit court duties, I don't think that that adequately protects the public interest. So that is the nature of our objection. My third and final point has to do with adjournment to another location or an alternate location. And Justice Anne Welsh Bradley, to answer your question, yes, the modification that is being suggested by the petitioner would allow a circuit court judge to adjourn the location of court to a gymnasium. And this is a decision that an individual judge in a jurisdiction would be able to make, which means we could have disparate results for litigants in the same jurisdiction. Moreover, the language here is not limited anymore, if the petition is adopted, to rescheduling the location of court as a result of war or a calamity. Literally, it says any other factor that impedes access to the courthouse would be justification for the circuit court judge making that action. That is a dramatic departure from the law as it is written today. And without limits, this could be, as long as it's within the state of Wisconsin, court could be relocated hundreds of miles away, or it could be relocated to a virtual space where individuals can't have access because of limited internet connections and connectivity. Thank you very much for going over your time. I'm able to answer any questions.
You have perfect timing. It's impeccable. Really, I mean, you
he's
just
kind
concluded.
Of a perfect lawyer, if you ask me.
I have a brief question. I know where you have time constraints, but really briefly, what did you do during the pandemic if you didn't have access to the internet? And did you have any clients, or are you aware of your colleagues having clients who were unable to participate in hearings when the entire court system went to Zoom?
I'm so happy you asked us that question. Asked me that question, because when I spoke in front of your honors virtually months ago, I could not do so from my house. I could not do so from my courthouse. I had to drive 45 minutes to an office that had a LAN connection to clip in. And then I had to practice that technology with your bailiff, actually, before I was able to appear. So I had to physically move myself to an area where there was a cable. I've had clients who have appeared in the parking lot with me, like, meeting them using a phone so they can come in. I've had clients who have cases in other jurisdictions traveling to other public defender offices. We've heard in Marathon County in particular of there being, you know, a Zoom-accessible device in the hallway that the client could go to the courthouse to the hallway, use the device that's available there to log into the courtroom, even though that client is literally standing next to the courtroom. So it's not always easy for our clients, and especially when we're talking about the types of devices that connect to internet, you know, these are not inexpensive, and public defenders represent indigent individuals. Not all of my clients have smartphones or personal computers. It would be awkward for them to use the library computer for a court appearance, but unless I problem solve that with my client ahead of time, that's sometimes their only option.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your patience, among other things, and we appreciate your comments.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you. All right. The court will meet in conference at 1:30.